We are back once again with another episode of Legal Perspective on Athletics. And with us, as usual, is Justin Sievert, partner at Sievert Worley. Justin, thanks so much for being with us once again.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's good to be back on to wrap up our fall semester of podcasts.
Well, it's been a great series, and I think just a ton of great information, and look forward to what's coming in the spring, and I know we're going to preview that at the end of this segment. But today we're talking about a component of Title IX that is often misunderstood, and that's the equitable treatment area, or the laundry list, as people refer to it. And that list is extensive, but today now we're going to talk about one component that is very important, and maybe perhaps one that is more within the control of an athletic department or an institution. And that's the aspect related to assignment and availability of coaching. And so I want to give people a sense for what it is we're talking about here today when we talk about the laundry list and that coaching component. So why don't you bring us up to speed?
Yeah, so if you've been following along the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about Title IX and the three different components of Title IX, with the last 2 weeks really looking at the full and effective accommodation of interests and abilities. And as you noted, today we're really going to shift towards looking at equitable treatment and the laundry list. So when we're looking at the laundry list, what we're really looking at is whether your school provides equivalent athletics benefits and opportunities for male and female student athletes. So one of the really big things to remember when looking at the laundry list is we're looking at the overall men's program versus the overall women's program. We're not looking at specific components of the laundry list against each other, and we're not looking at specific sports from the opposite genders against each other. So you're not really looking at, you know, are the women's uniforms better than the men's uniforms by itself? And you're not really looking at does men's basketball or women's basketball, which one is more favored. You're looking at the overall programs against each other. So really, it's really, really important to make sure you're educating and explaining this to your coaches, to your student athletes, and other parties on campus who have Title IX questions, because there's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about Title IX, and these misconceptions and misunderstandings really fuel most Title IX issues.
I think that's a real important point to reinforce, because in my work, I know I come across it all the time, where people have a perceived Title IX issue because they tell me, well, you know, our men's basketball coach is getting paid way more than our women's basketball coach. That's a problem. And it may be, in fact, a problem, but it may not be a problem, because you need to look at the broader picture, and I think that's part of what you're trying to say. Well, let's look at this one component today, which is the opportunity to receive coaching and the compensation of coaching as a part of this laundry list area.
Yeah, so I think before kind of going into each of those areas of coaching, I think there's three really important things to remember when looking at the laundry list. And the first thing is that Title IX doesn't mandate identical benefits and opportunities or treatment. It allows you to offset these various areas. So when you're looking at the overall men's and women's programs, you can always offset a benefit for one sex against the benefit of another sex. So that's why you look at it from an overall perspective. Additionally, I really think it's important to understand that Title IX acknowledges that not all sports are alike. So there are going to be differences in sports can result in differences of treatment, as long as those differences are based on the sport and not some type of determination based on sex. So for example, a program like football is obviously going to have more coaches in other sports because there's more roster spots on a football program. It's just there's simply more student athletes to be coached. Additionally, I think it's really important to know that there's also non-discriminatory differences between aspects of the laundry list items that allow for different treatment. And we're going to go into a little bit more of that when we talk about the compensation of coaches. But to really look at the coaching aspect of the laundry list itself, as you noted, there's really three different parts of the laundry list as it relates to coaching. You're talking about the availability of coaches, the assignment of coaches, and the compensation of coaches. When we look at that first part, the availability of coaches, the first thing we're talking about is the number of coaches for each athletics program. We're talking about the number of full-time coaches, part-time coaches, volunteer coaches, anybody that has coaching responsibilities within a program. And when you're looking at that, one of the big issues you see is, well, how do we measure programs that have both full and part-time coaches? And a really good way to do that for calculation purposes is to figure out a way to convert part-time positions to full-time equivalents and then make those measurements for your programs. Additionally, there's really it's another thing to look at with the availability of coaches is that you also really need to make sure you're looking at the number of volunteer coaches and making sure the number doesn't provide any type of unintended imbalance between your male and female programs. And that could be something like if you're giving one program office space for your volunteer coaches, but you're not giving other programs that same opportunity, that could be creating an unintended imbalance. I think the final thing to look at with the availability of coaches is whether the coaches are actually accessible. For example, if you're relying on a part-time head coach for one sex, but you're not relying on part-time head coaches for another sex, that can be problematic because part-time coaches usually aren't as available to team members to the same degree as full-time coaches, even if the full-time coach has other job responsibilities, just because the part-time coach usually isn't on campus and available during the day. Additionally, coaches who have offices within the athletics building and aren't on some remote part of campus away from students are usually much more accessible to their student athletes. So you want to make sure office spaces are set up so student athletes have equal access to their coaches.
Okay, that's real helpful, I think, for people to understand, Justin. But what about the next piece to this, which is the assignment of coaches? What are we talking about there?
So with the assignment of coaches, we're really looking at, is your institution staffing programs with experienced and qualified coaches? And is that equitable for each sex? Because obviously providing a well-qualified coaches for teams of one sex and not the other is very dangerous. This obviously isn't to say that you're going to have coaches who are better for one program than another, but the institution should be able to have some sort of relevant uniform criteria for the selection of your coaches. That should be set up before you're engaged in the hiring process. So when you're really going through that process, you want to make sure that all your efforts are generating a quality pool of applicants in every situation, and that you're really selecting the most qualified candidate for the job. One of the big issues with this is that we often see a head coach of some of your smaller programs being an assistant coach for some of the bigger programs. So they have a dual role where they're maybe your assistant men's basketball coach is also a head golf coach or something of that nature. And while this isn't impermissible, you need to be careful that all sports have appropriate coaches who are qualified and available, because if they're not taking their head coaching role seriously, you may run into some problems there.
That makes a lot of sense, and especially at the smaller level, you do see some of that, the dual coaching roles, and sometimes, again, unintentionally, there could be some inequities there, so I appreciate you clarifying that. Now, the last piece to this is the compensation piece, and you kind of prompted this about that early on. What do we need to be thinking about here related to the compensation of coaches?
Compensation of coaches is probably one of the most talked about issues on campus related to Title IX. A lot of times you'll see, you know, institutions or just they have on their EADA report, they'll have some type of compensation listed for the coaches of programs. And that can cause a lot of discussion amongst various campus constituencies. And I think it's important to remember that with compensation, non-discriminatory discrepancies are defensible as long as you're documenting those discrepancies and you have a list of factors that go into your compensation decision. So if you have a coach who has been around a long time and has been very successful and has a demonstrated success at your institution, obviously that coach is going to make more than a head coach that's entering their first year of actually being a head coach. Because they have, you know, a history of success. Additionally, if a coach has different responsibilities than another coach, maybe those are non-coaching responsibilities. Maybe those are just more responsibilities as it relates to their program, such as you see at some of the revenue sports. Those are also non-discriminatory differences. So as long as you're documenting why those compensation decisions are made, and those are applied fairly in every compensation negotiation, then you're going to be okay there as well. I think one of the final things to look at with compensation of coaches is really looking at the employment arrangement itself. You want to be looking at, do we have some coaches who are at will coaches? Do we have other coaches who are coaching who their contract is for a different period of time? Looking at, do we have, one gender who has 10-month contracts? Do we have the other gender who has 12-month contracts? Things like that. Do we have some coaches who are on a 1-year renewable contract? Do other coaches have contracts for a period of years? Things like that should all be looked at with the compensation of coaches. And the final thing, which I touched on a bit earlier, is the duties of your coaches. And this is especially true at Division II and III institutions, where you have a lot of coaches who have non-coaching responsibilities. When you're looking at assigning secondary responsibilities to coaches, you really want to make sure that these are being done in an equitable manner. You don't want to have coaches for one gender having, assignments that are very relaxed and they don't require a lot of responsibility, where you have coaches for the other gender maybe teaching substantive courses for one of your degree programs, because those aren't really equitable responsibilities.
Okay, Justin, this has been real helpful. And now I'm sitting here thinking about, well, if I was an athletic director still, what should I be doing? What can ADs do to think about this for their own programs right now?
Yeah, I think the difficult part for an athletic director is even if you do a Title IX audit, and even if you have a gender equity improvement plan to address any issues, it's really hard to be able to answer questions and to feel prepared to answer questions in real time, to really address issues as they come rather than on sort of an annual basis. So I think with coaching, the specific coaching component, I think there's, a few questions you should always be prepared to answer at any given time, so you can always address issues that may come to you. So I think the first thing is just really looking at, do we have an equitable number of coaches for men's and women's athletics programs? The second question, really looking at, what's the relative experience and quality of the coaches for both men's and women's programs? And are any teams being disadvantaged as a result of, the number, the qualifications and experience of these coaches? And then moving on to compensation, are we taking an equitable approach with the contracts of our coaches? Do we have a written basis for any compensation differences for the coaches? And then finally, what are the actual duties being performed by the coaches? And have we assigned any non-coaching duties in an equitable manner? I think those are some basic questions that allow you to really be comfortable answering questions on any of the three parts of the coaching component.
Great. I think that's really helpful. And I know that sometimes things happen within a department. Positions are grown or they evolve over time. And sometimes you can create these situations where things may be a bit inequitable. And I think these are good questions to ask. So I appreciate your insights on that. Well, this has been a great, look at Title IX components. And this whole series this fall has been, I think, extremely helpful for people to gain better understandings into the world of compliance and the legal aspects of intercollegiate athletics. But we're not done. We're going to take a brief hiatus here during the holiday season, but you're going to be back with us in the spring. What can we expect to hear from you coming in the spring months?
Yeah, so I think with our fall semester, we really focused on some of the regulatory issues in college athletics. We talked about NCAA compliance, we talked about NCAA enforcement, and we talked about Title IX. We're going to shift gears in the spring and really start to talk about more of the business issues in college athletics. And how the law relates to those issues. So we're going to look at various types of contracts and some of the best practices in securing those deals. We're going to look at the Fair Labor Standards Act, and we're going to look at things such as if your school is running any type of contest or giveaway. And I think the important takeaway in the spring is going to be that you don't want to spend money on litigation. That can get out of hand very easily in terms of control and costs and outcomes. So it's really important from a contractual standpoint to really make sure you protect your interests up front So hopefully in the spring, we'll be able to provide you some takeaways that will allow you a good start on protecting your interests in that regard and really managing your risk before any issues occur.
Well, I can't wait. I think that's some great stuff coming in the spring, and can't wait to spend some more time with you and learn about these areas that I think most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about. And this has, again, been a real helpful segment, I hope, for everybody to gain some insights into some areas that they may not normally think about. Well, we're going to wrap up this issue, and I want to thank you again, Justin, for being with us, and appreciate you taking time as usual.
Yeah, Mark, thanks for having me. It was a great semester, and I look forward to being back with you in the spring.
Well, and we will be back, and I want to thank everybody. For Justin Sievert, I'm Mark Majeski, and this has been Perspective on Athletics.